call to order this hearing of the Tax Reform Division of the Senate Committee on Taxes, Monday, March 9th, 2015. Would ask members to look at the minutes from the previous hearing and indicate whether there are any corrections to be made.
Move acceptance of the minutes, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Thompson. Senator Thompson moves that the minutes of March 4th be approved. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. Senate File 1107 will be presented by Senator Kozelka on behalf of Senator Clausen. Welcome to the division.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And we're happy to hear Senate File 1107.
Madam Chair, members, this bill provides a refundable tax credit for the amount of 10% additional federal tax applied to early withdrawal from qualified retirement plans if the withdrawn funds are used to pay for qualifying long-term care expenses or pay premiums for long-term care insurance. Under federal law, the additional tax is imposed if non-qualifying early withdrawals are made from the retirement plans. That's before age 59 and a half. This would be effective beginning in tax year 2015. Thank you. With that, Madam Chair, members, we have Toby Pearson to testify on the bill as well.
Senator Kozelka, apparently we do not have a revenue estimate for this bill. Has Senator Clausen received any information from or yourself?
Madam Chair, I believe I saw something this morning. I read the email. I think
I just haven't seen the piece of paper.
Okay.
I see now I have it, and it apparently is unknown.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
I hadn't seen that before. Is it in the packets? No.
Yes. It should be in the packets. It was in the stuff to
okay.
go in the packets.
So we have one testifier, Mr. Oh, well, we have two. We have one name. We'll start with that person, Mr. Pearson from Care Providers. If you'd identify yourself for the record, and then we'll proceed to the second witness. Welcome
Madam
to
Chair,
the
members, my name is Toby Pearson with Care Providers of Minnesota. I'm here today with Carrie Thurlow from Leading Age Minnesota. Together, we're the long-term care imperative at the Capitol.
I'm going to ask you to speak louder, if you will, and maybe move the mic closer
sure.
to you.
We seem to have that problem in this room more
That's
often
better.
Than not.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we would like to speak in favor of this bill for a variety of reasons. One is that, as you know, there will be 60,000 new seniors each year, thanks to many baby boomers starting to age. And demographically, we need to start to plan not only for now, but also for the future. With these increased demand for services, we need ongoing ways in which to look at and evaluate how are we going to pay for these services and how are we going to incent people to pay for these services. So one of the things that the Long-Term Care Imperative did was set out a group of proposals to look at a variety of ways, another tool in the toolbox, if we use one of the phrases around the Capitol quite often. And what we wanted to do was help families get prepared for the future. And when we evaluate this bill for tax credits, we think it should be a bill considered in that toolbox for possible use for families moving forward. To plan not only for now, but also for their future needs of long-term care. Thank you.
Thank you. Ma'am, if you would identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Senior Vice President of Advocacy for Leading Age Minnesota, also here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. And I will be similarly brief in my comments in support of this particular bill. But do want to echo many of the comments that Mr. Pearson has made. As we know, we are all getting older. Minnesota is about to experience an unprecedented age wave. But two corresponding facts to that are that we know that the majority of Minnesotans have not planned for or saved for sufficiently for their long-term care needs. We know that probably one approach is not going to be right for all families here in Minnesota, and we need to expand the variety of options available to families and seniors to plan for and better save for their long-term care needs. We also know that as Minnesotans age, it is more likely than not that they will need some form of long-term care. I think once individuals hit about that 80-year mark, I think it's two out of every three seniors will need some form of long-term care. It may not necessarily be a nursing home, but it will need some supports. So we are getting older. We will more likely than not need long-term care services, and we know that we're not planning for and saving for enough. So we really appreciate this particular bill as being one of those approaches that can expand the options and tools available for families to plan and save for their own long-term care needs. So with that, again, we just want to echo support for this bill and encourage its passage.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, one other comment from my part. The earlier that people choose to buy long-term care insurance, the lower the insurance rates. And so it's not just that we want people to buy it. It's a real benefit if we get them to buy it sooner because it's more affordable for them. This, you know, that penalty starts at 59.5. If people started buying it at 60 or 61 or 2 or 3, that would be a big savings for them. And so this, I think, is a step in the right direction for that as well.
Senator Gazelka and your witnesses, is it Senator Clausen's intent that it would only apply to expenses for the taxpayer? I'm looking at the discussion on the revenue estimate that with the statement the bill does not specify whether the credit would apply to expenses only for the taxpayer's spouse or if it would also apply to expenses for dependents or other persons. Is this intended only for the taxpayer?
Madam Chair, I do not know.
Okay, I think that the reason why there's no number, I assuming from reading the description here, no number for the on the revenue estimate is that there's not enough information to...
Madam Chair,
there's not enough information, and later on, so there are a couple of things. One is the who is it going to apply to, and then although we have information that people have withdrawn. Early withdrawals and paid the tax. We don't know the reasons why, and so that makes it not really ambiguous for the department to make a revenue estimate based on. I mean, how many people actually do make these withdrawals for a serious purpose? How many of them are, you know, need or have made them because their houses are underwater or something and they need to make mortgage payments and they'd rather pay the 10% tax than lose their house? I mean, there are all kinds of legitimate reasons maybe, but not related to health. And so they haven't been able to do that. You might talk to Senator Clausen and say that there needs to be a whole lot more specificity within the bill of items that actually can be determined to before we would we could seriously consider this proposal in the omnibus. Fair enough?
Yep.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Any further discussion? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Pearson or Ms. Thurlow, I think I read somewhere or heard that a relatively large percentage of people who have long-term care insurance don't ever use it. I mean, either they die or the insurance premiums get so expensive that they drop it before they can start to utilize the insurance. Is that accurate? And would this bill, how would this bill address that issue? Is there something there that would be helpful to individuals? And I heard Senator Gazelka talk about keeping the costs down, so that was helpful.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, I'm not familiar with the exact statistics on that.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, I don't think Senator that's Excel. Accurate. What the conversation that's when has been going out in the past is when people buy long-term care insurance, because we have the partnership programs that gone out around the country, they have found that there's not many state dollars spent because the people had long-term care insurance. And typically when you buy long-term care, the rate is mostly locked in. It's not, it doesn't keep going up where it becomes unaffordable, at least the plans today. And so what has happened is when people actually took care of that responsibility themselves, even if they got the partnership plan, which basically allows you to protect some of your assets more than you would have been able to otherwise, but they found that the state really didn't have to come in and pay because that person took care of it. So that's the main statistic going around, but most people that buy one, it actually pays out, you know, because the odds are very, very high that it's going to be used. But, and that's why it's expensive. But if we can get people to get it earlier, I think more people will buy it.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Skoy.
So, thank you, Manager. So, Senator Gazelka, what the point is here is that you would keep the costs down so over the time period, the people, when they get to be 85 or they actually need it, they would still be able to have afforded it. Because, and somewhere in my recollection, I thought I'd read that a very small percentage of people actually utilize the long-term care insurance because it gets expensive or they have already died.
And Madam Chair, Senator Skoy, if they had one of the older policies pre-2006, a lot of those, as the benefits went up, the costs went up, and therefore that was accurate. But since then, I have not seen that to be the case.
So. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator. That's
you.
Helpful.
Thank you, Senator Skoy. I'm looking further in the revenue estimate, and apparently now, and maybe we should have already known this, if you withdraw from a retirement plan because of total and permanent disability or for medical expenses directly, there is no penalty. And the department would expect only a very limited number of cases to withdraw for long-term care expenses. So I'm anticipating that amount, that the revenue estimate would probably not be, you know, millions and millions of dollars. It's probably something fairly modest, quite frankly. But anyway, we will lay the bill over. Senator Gazelka moves. We can do it himself.
I move that motion.
Moves that Senate file 1107 be laid over for further consideration in the omnibus tax bill. Senator Dames.
Take action on that.
Oh. All in favor of Senator Gazelka's motion?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. See here. Senator Dames brings us Senate File 1097.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome
members.
To the committee.
Madam Chair, there is a A5 amendment, which is a delete all amendment. I would appreciate if that could be moved.
Senator Thompson moves the A5 amendment, is it?
Do we have?
Yes. That is correct, Madam
all
Chair.
In favor of that motion?
It is not in the folder.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. I need to have it. I don't have a copy.
Madam Chair, we don't have it.
I don't have it. The members have. We will certainly do that, but I want to make sure we have a copy of it. Just wait 1 second, and we.
Oh my God! Yeah. We'll just start talking about it a little bit.
We don't have it.
We had. It was in the stuff. It was in the packet.
Okay, Senator Dames, we need to have more copies made of it for all the members. So why don't you discuss it as if we had adopted it, and then as soon as it gets here, we will act on it formally, Senator Dames. Senate File 1097, as proposed to be amended by the A5, and you may speak to the A5, and then we'll take care of it later.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The A5 amendment will bring the bill into the form that I would like to have it in. Once the bill is amended, this bill will provide for a refundable tax credit for employees who graduate from 2- and 4-year institutions with a degree in the fields of science, technology, engineering, math, and health care, and enter into employment in the science, technology, engineering, math, long-term care in a region where there's job vacancies in the corresponding fields. This credit is 50% of the maximum amount set under the current law for tuition and fees for 2- and 4-year institutions from which an individual obtained the degree. The credit is available in the tax year in which the degree was obtained and the following 4 tax years thereafter. Effective beginning in the tax year of 2015. The provisions of the bill, subdivision 1, talks about and defines the eligibility of individuals, the maximum qualifying amount, and the development regions and the qualified fields. Subdivision 2 authorizes and talks about the credits. Subdivision 3 requires the Commissioner of Deed to determine a qualified economic development regions for the current tax years, and a job based on job data availability. And then subdivision 4 allows for the credits to be refundable. I do have 2 testifiers today, Madam Chair and members. We have Katie Thurl from the Leading Age and Toby Pearson from Care Providers of Minnesota. So at this time, if you would like, I will turn it over to Katie Thurl for her testimony.
Ms. Thurlow, welcome back to the witness table, and if you'd identify yourself, please, again, for the record, please give us your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I'm Carrie Thurlow with Leading Age Minnesota here on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative. I want to thank Senator Dames for bringing this bill forward. So the last bill we just discussed talked about the age wave and sort of the need to give individuals more tools to plan for their long-term care needs. Another impact to the growing age wave here in Minnesota is that we will need more formal caregivers than we have today. Unfortunately, even today, we have a shortage of professional caregivers needed to take care of the seniors we have today. I personally represent a statewide organization of senior care providers, including nursing homes, home health, assisted living, hospice, and sort of the spectrum of senior care providers. The number one issue that they have identified as needing to be addressed immediately is to build the pipeline and to get more people into professional caregiving careers. Currently, we estimate that just in nursing homes alone, we have 1,800 vacant positions open today. Many of those positions are not getting any applications. There's a wide variety of reasons for that. But we think that this particular approach is one way that we can start building that pipeline to getting more people into caregiving careers. The shortages exist not just for nurses in long-term care, but also for CNAs. And this bill would help individuals in both those type of professions going forward. The impact of not building this pipeline, of not getting more people into professional caregiving careers, is that quite simply caregivers or senior care providers have to turn seniors away. And so recently what we have seen in some communities in Minnesota are that nursing homes have beds open. waiting lists for seniors in their communities to come in, but they need to turn away those seniors. And in some cases, in Alexandria, Minnesota, that meant that they actually had to close nursing home beds because they don't have staff to staff those beds, and sent those seniors to North Dakota for care. We have heard of other seniors in other rural parts of the states having to find care more than 100 miles away from their home community. And that has impacts on their communities and their families as well. So building the pipeline with approaches like this is more than helpful to address our shortage of caregivers.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Toby Pearson, again with Care Providers of Minnesota. As Ms. Thurlow mentioned, I think there's a couple things that we face and we've heard from our memberships is that we have a demographic problem, meaning we have a number, 60,000, of people turning 65 and older that are going to need care that we need to start to plan for. The second part, as Ms. Thurlow mentioned, is we also have a demographic challenge out in greater Minnesota as far as recruiting and retaining quality caregivers, meaning we aren't training enough caregivers fast enough to take care of the people who are turning over 80 and starting to need more and more care. So as Ms. Thurlow said, this is another approach that we need to look at as far as training and maintaining quality caregivers in our various settings, and we appreciate you considering this bill.
Questions or comments for the witnesses or for Senator Dames? Senator Dames, we have a revenue estimate that is an unknown.
Yes.
And apparently the explanation for why it's unknown comes in the last bullet on the second page.
Right.
Where it says, because the qualified regions and fields would be expected to change from year to year because the higher rates by region and field are unknown, the revenue impact of the tax credit is unknown. You know, what we have done in the past, I think in certain equally indeterminate situations, instead of doing a credit that is actually an entitlement. That is, if you qualify, you get it. I mean, that's what it amounts to, like Social Security. If you qualify, you get it. If you're 5 years old, you get to go to school. That's an entitlement. Is to have a set number of dollars that would support the program and then have people apply for it. And after, in any given year, when that total amount is reached, then it's capped. And we do that with the Angel Investment Credit in Greater Minnesota and in the metro area too, I guess. And we have found out that particular credit for businesses, it gets all used up. What department does that?
Deed.
It's indeed that it gets used up in the first 4 or 5 months, which shows that it's used. So you might want to think to talk to your supporters in this and see if something like that would be a better approach to support. And that goes for Senator Clausen, too, I think, to support the goals on your bill, which I think are really great. But we really don't know how much, if it's an entitlement program, that it would cost, and the department has indicated that. So see if there's another way to get there, and if so, why don't you let Senator Scoy and I know about that? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We will do that. We will take a look at some numbers and regionality and things like that and get back to you with all that information.
Okay. We do have the A5 amendment in front of us then. Senator Scoy moves the A5 amendment to Senate File 1097. It was Senator Thompson's motion. on the A5 amendment. All those in favor of the A5 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and the A5 amendment is adopted. Senator Thame, thank you very much for bringing this bill before us. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Dames, I don't know if you've thought about this, but I was looking at the list of qualifying degrees. Any thought about if there's a split between those three? I mean, are half of them going to be health care? Have you given any thought to that in order to try to figure out how many numbers you might want? That might be something we would contemplate.
And thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Skoy, we will certainly take that into account. That's a good suggestion to help us start putting a number together that is a realistic number that would work. Thank you.
With the specified fields, if the need is really in health care workers. Okay?
Thank you.
Okay. Then Senator Thompson moves that Senate File 1097 as amended be laid over for further consideration in the omnibus tax bill. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. Thank you. Who's next? Senator Fischbach. Senate File 855. Sticking with long-term care. Welcome to the committee. Senator Fischbach, is the bill in the shape you want it?
Yes, it is, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Then please proceed.
And Madam Chair, committee, it's a pretty simple bill. The bill increases, it would increase the existing long-term care insurance credit rate to 50% of eligible premiums and increase the maximum credit from 100 to 200 per beneficiary. So it would be $400 for married filing jointly and $200 for all other filers. It's pretty simple. It's an existing program that we're just expanding slightly.
Senator Fischbach, are you aware of when the credit was established? Was it ever changed? Or was it established? And maybe if I look on the revenue note, I'd find that.
Madam Chair, I don't know if it has been changed, but the credit was enacted in 97, and then took effect in 99. It took effect in 99. It was established in 97.
So it's been out there for some 15 years or so at $100. And is that per person, or is it $100 per joint filers? I mean,
Madam Chair, my understanding is that it's per filer. So it would, right now, if you're married filing jointly, you could do $200.
Okay.
Under this, you could do
$400. $100 for each individual. Do you know what kind of information you have to provide to get it?
Madam Chair, to qualify, you have for the federal. Excuse me. To qualify for the credit, the long-term care policy must qualify for the federal itemized deduction for medical expenses and have a lifetime long-term care benefit limit of $100,000 or more. So those I don't know if that's exactly your question, but those are the qualifications.
Well, and then the additional information is that you have to provide the company and the, on the form, the company and the policy numbers, as far as I know, so that it becomes an auditable tax credit. And is it it remains a non-refundable tax credit in your bill, too. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, yes, that is correct.
Okay. And the biennial cost is $18 million. Is there comments for Senator Fischbach? And just for members, this is it's a scalable item. We could look at an increase that was not a doubling. We could look at something that was adding another $25 at any point. But the major thing is that this bill is saying that it's time for an increase.
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
Anything further for Senator Fischbach? Seeing none, Senator Dietzick moves that Senate File 855 be laid over for further consideration in the omnibus tax bill. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you very much,
Senator
Chair.
Fischbach. Senator Benson. Senator Benson brings us Senate File 809, and Senator Benson and I did have an exchange about how she would prefer this amendment to be adopted, which is a little bit not usual, I'll put it that way. But have you thought about it further, and how would you like for us to consider Senate File 809?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And Senate File 809 and the Delete Everything Amendment aim to accomplish similar goals, to chip away at the problem of workforce problems in greater Minnesota in particular. And I believe my amendment is better policy, but because the language in Senate File 809 has been laid over for inclusion in the House, I would like the committee's judgment as to whether or not you would like the language to match up or to have me advocate for what I believe is better policy, and that is in the amendment. I prefer the better policy, but
absolutely,
I know that there are other considerations.
we opt for number two.
Okay.
So Senator Gazelka moves the A1 amendment. It is an author's amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. We now have Senate File 809 as amended before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And actually, this idea begins with Senate File 5, which is Senator Claussen's bill dealing with workforce shortages in greater Minnesota through loan forgiveness. And as a member of the Human Services Committee, Senator Eaton has heard a number of times that we are facing workforce challenges of all types, including physicians, dentists, physician assistants. And so what the amendment that you just adopted does is take the idea from 809, combine it with Senator Claussen's loan forgiveness, but for those doctors, those medical professionals, those dentists who do not have debt that they need forgiven, they could volunteer hours. And I set the number at 120 hours a year so that they would be committed and part of a workforce, not cost the facilities more money through salaries, but be part of the planning for care providing. The bill as drafted, I did include federally qualified health centers, but the note from revenue indicates that because they are fully staffed, revenue doesn't believe anyone would take charity care at the federally qualified health centers, and so that is something that we will actually have to see develop going forward. However, this does deal with issues of charity care in greater Minnesota. The revenue note, which you should have before you, is significantly smaller than originally presented, because the revenue rate or the reimbursement rate on your original note was much higher. You will see if you look at the revenue analysis, physicians are only reimbursed at 26.7% of their full fee. So this is really a little nudge, a little thank you to those medical professionals who are already doing this work. And so I would yield to the committee for further questions.
Senator Benson, do you think that that amount is enough of an incentive for these medical professionals to engage in this charity care? Or I often hear from some medical professionals that there's just too much paperwork involved for doing charity care. What do you think this would do it at that level? I mean, your revenue estimate went from, you know, almost $7 million to $600,000 in fiscal 2017. Is that enough? Senators, you go ahead and answer that, and then I'll call
Madam
on
Chair,
Senator Scoy.
When I saw the great change in the fiscal note, I hoped that we could consider reducing the number of required hours or something along those lines so that even if a dentist was just here for the summer and wanted to work in a clinic, say in Senator Gazelka's district or in Senator Coonan's district, that they would be willing to do that. So if the committee is amenable, we could perhaps cut the number of hours. Madam Chair, it looked as though Senator Scoy had a suggestion.
I'll call on you in just a second. This is another proposal that is scalable.
Yes.
And you might want to work with the Department of Revenue and maybe set up a schedule of these qualifiers and see what happens to the revenue estimate if you did do things like reduce the number of hours or increase the percentage a little bit or something. I would be concerned that we would not have the desired result that you're looking for. Senator Scoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Benson, and I guess to the committee, the number on here that I would draw your attention to is on the second to the bottom line. And that is the assumption that the department is making that the reimbursement rate for MA is 26% of the full fee. So when a physician or a dentist is providing care and not getting getting reimbursed from MA is 26.7% of the full fee. That's the MA reimbursement rate. This is really, it's a very small part of the problem that we're facing with regard to uncompensated care. And it's called charity care, but it's uncompensated care.
Right.
And it could be done in an emergency room or any number of places. And I'm real interested in this, Senator Benson. I don't know exactly what the mechanism is or what we should do here. And personally, I would prefer if it was a statewide bill. It's just kind of my predisposition that if these are needed anywhere, they're needed everywhere. But I think it's real interesting. But members, I'd draw your attention to that reimbursement rate for MA. It's extremely low.
Senator Benson, I think you're hearing that we like your bill.
Well, and also
but,
Carver.
And we don't usually say this. It doesn't cost enough. Okay? It doesn't give enough relief to achieve the goals that you're looking at. So we really do encourage you to look at something, either a statewide, as Senator Scoy mentioned, or something that's more that really does act as more of an incentive for and a thank you, as you mentioned. It's an incentive, but it's also a thank you for those medical professionals that undertake uncompensated charity care.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Scoy.
I was drawn, staff draw my attention, that it really truly could be considered a statewide bill, primarily in the metropolitan area. This care is provided by federally qualified health centers, and they have salaried staff, so charity care would not affect the incomes.
And
Madam Senator
Chair,
Benson.
And Senator Scoy, it was my understanding from the federally qualified centers that they could take volunteers to do the charity care, but revenue looked at it as them being fully staffed and so didn't have need. But I will tell you there is need at the federally qualified health centers in the metro, and so perhaps what I need to do to bump the number, as you would refer to it, talk to the representatives from the federally qualified health centers and ask them their capacity for charity care. Give that number to revenue, and then maybe we get to the answer that you're looking for.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree. I have a federally qualified health center in my district, and they are fully staffed, but the number of patients that line up to come in there, they could double. They just don't have the they might have a space issue, but then they also have a funding issue. And then I know there's one in Senator Champion's district that also the number of people the waits aren't horrendous, but they could serve a lot more people than they have right now. Because dentists is one area where they are in need.
And Madam Chair, if I
Senator
may.
Senator Benson.
To Senator Scoy's point, the reimbursement rate for physicians, you'll notice on the back the reimbursement rate for dentists and mental health professionals, that is not something that we can easily change. And so I think changing the number of hours, perhaps, and looking at the federally qualified health centers as another source might be our best path forward to provide the incentives you're looking for.
Good. Further discussion on Senate file 809.
Madam Chair.
Senator Scoy.
If I could, and Senator Benson, I don't know where this path this bill has or is going. I would be curious what the committee, Health and Human Services Committee, and the interactions with some of their critical care centers for, and if, you know, there will be interactions with other facilities and how that interacts. So
Senator
I don't know
Benson,
if going
are you on
there
that
or not.
Committee?
And yes, ma'am, I am. Yes, Senator Rest, I am on that committee.
We would
and
encourage you to explore that relationship.
And actually, Senator Claussen has signed on to my bill that was the delete everything amendment, and we have not had the chance to hear that as yet. So I hope we do have a chance to talk about those interactions, and I'll work with the representatives from the federally qualified clinics to see if we can expand this bill, and then I'll continue to work with your staff, Madam Chair.
yeah, Senator Benson, I think the tax committee does consider this a tax issue.
Yes.
But I think you would do well to visit with the chairs of the policy committee and the finance committee on health and human services as to what it is we've been discussing here.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. There being no further discussion, Senator Scoy moves that Senate file 809 as amended be laid on the table for further consideration in the omnibus tax bill. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
The last bill on the agenda is Senate file 1253. It's a bill we have seen before. The Department of Revenue has provided a PowerPoint for us to look at it. It's my bill. It is a very complicated area of our tax code, and I hope that their presentation will be enlightening. Mr. Cummings, who's going to do the presentation?
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Cummings.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, my name is Paul Cummings. I'm the tax policy manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I wanted to introduce Mr. John O'Mahony. He's a staff attorney at the Department of Revenue, and he's going to be helping us to kind of go through some of the background about net operating losses. So he'll be talking about what is a net operating loss, the history of loss trafficking, a federal legislation on net operating losses, and talking about some comparisons between Minnesota and the other state that primarily does this, which is New Jersey. I'll have some remarks at the conclusion of Mr. O'Mahony's testimony. And so with that, Mr. Chair and Madam Chair, I would turn it over to Mr. O'Mahony.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. O'Mahony, and identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John O'Mahony. I'm a staff attorney at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity to provide you some additional context and some factual background for what Chair Rest referred to as a complicated area of the law. I would agree with that. And because of that, we're going to start from a sort of basic level. I mean, not to talk down to the committee, Certainly, most of you are probably familiar with what a net operating loss is, but just to provide a little bit of a refresher and perhaps information to persons in the audience, a net operating loss is what occurs in a given year for a corporation or an individual when allowable deductions exceed taxable income. Now, if carrybacks and carryovers of net operating losses were not allowed for federal purposes, those losses would go unutilized, and for that reason, carrybacks and carryforwards are allowed to sort of ameliorate what would be the drastic effects of taxing income in sort of inflexible 12-month periods. The first carryover legislation that was ever introduced was in 1918. It provided for a one-year carryback and one-year carryforward. From 1913 to 1918, there were none. That was originally intended as a war effort stimulus. And as I said before, it allows taxpayers to sort of smooth out the reporting of income and losses over time. Now, since 1918 and all the way up until today, a problem can occur when you allow people to carry losses backward and forward, and that is people who have losses that might not be able to use them would like to get rid of them, and people who have income that could be offset by losses would like to get a hold of them. Because of that, there have always been loss trafficking efforts that have been targeted by the IRS. Early legislation on this was very restrictive, and the first case that you see percolate to the United States Supreme Court was in 1934 in the New Colonial Ice versus Helvering decision. In that decision, the Supreme Court ruled that the requirement that the taxpayer generating the losses be the same taxpayer that offset the losses with income was hyperformal, and even a change in basically name only was too much to allow for losses to be carried forward any further. The 1939 code overhaul saw some loosening of those restrictions, especially with regard to corporate reorganizations. And the next case that you see percolate to the U.S. Supreme Court level is Lipson Shop versus Kohler. And in that decision, the United States Supreme Court announced the new rule, which would be that losses would be able to be carried forward from one company to another, but only in as much as the business activity that generated the losses was the same business activity generating the income to be offset in future years. That's a quote that I won't read to you, but if you ever get back to looking at it, it's interesting and a good explanation of loss carryover policy. In the 1954 code overhaul, you see this being addressed again by the United States Congress. They introduced Internal Revenue Code sections 381 and 382. That is where the reorganization rules and carryover limitation rules still reside in the code. Those were written very differently than their current versions. They were not particularly successful. There was a great disagreement between taxpayers and the IRS in the 32-year period leading up to the next code overhaul, and successful regulations under at least the 382 provision were never promulgated. In the 1986 code overhaul, you see the introduction of the modern Section 382 limitation, which still exists today, and the IRS has successfully promulgated multiple is not even a good enough word, really, voluminous regulations under that provision. The provision is intended to prevent losses from being trafficked between companies in a way that doesn't reflect what would be economically appropriate. The way that the provision works is it kicks in a limitation whenever there is a change in ownership of a loss corporation. The definition of a loss corporation is any corporation that has unutilized net operating losses as of January 1st of a given year. And I'm sorry to get into sort of the technical minutia, but it is important for a couple of slides later. A change in ownership is something that occurs when any group of 5% shareholders within a three-year period acquires more than 50% of a given corporation. Now, sort of getting back to a more high level, what the Section 382 limitation actually does, it says if you go out and acquire a loss corporation, you will only be able to offset your income in future years with its losses by the Section 382 limitation. And you calculate that limitation by taking the value of the loss corporation at the time of change in ownership. So if you're thinking of a simple transaction where one buyer goes out and purchases one company, it's basically what you pay for the company, times the IRS long-term rate, which currently sits at 2.7%. That's just basically to provide for some interest as you're going forward and keeping your losses accrued on your books. The effect of this is if you're going out to purchase a company, it's never really economically viable for you to say, I don't know if the assets of this company are something that are going to fit in well, but it has enough tax losses that it would be economically beneficial for me to purchase it. Because the limitation is going to put you down 30 cents on every dollar in actual tax savings that you could get from their losses, assuming a 30% tax rate. The other thing that I want to talk to you about is a comparison between NOL provisions in New Jersey and Minnesota, and that's because New Jersey has legislation similar to what is being proposed in this bill, but New Jersey's laws are somewhat different than Minnesota's in this particular area. Minnesota law adopts the federal definition of a net operating loss under Internal Revenue Code Section 172, where New Jersey actually defines net operating loss separately, and New Jersey net operating losses, for anybody who works in the state and local tax world, are drastically different than federal net operating losses or net operating losses in states that adopt the federal system in that area. In order to combat loss trafficking, Minnesota adopts the Section 382 limitation and calculates it in the same way that the federal government does. New Jersey does not. The 382 limitation has never been adopted in New Jersey. And in fact, New Jersey has a series of limitations on net operating loss carryforwards that are somewhat more stringent or severe and really harken back to the early federal system. Specifically, New Jersey disallows net operating loss carryovers if there's any 50% change or more in ownership if a taxpayer changes its trade or business. That's something that harkens back to the Section 382 limitation from 1954 and also kind of echoes the logic behind the Lipson-Shop decision. New Jersey also disallows net operating losses if an entity is acquired for the purposes of absorbing tax attributes, which is not something that has ever been on the books in Minnesota, or, well, actually it was for the feds back in the 39 code. New Jersey also disallows net operating loss carryovers for any corporation that changes its state of incorporation. This is a really hyper-formal requirement that really echoes the logic that's behind the new Colonial Ice decision back in 1934. Finally, New Jersey also disallows net operating losses following a merger, except for losses that were generated by a company surviving the merger that were generated before the merger took place. Again, this kind of goes back to the logic behind New Colonial Ice. If you're not the company that made the losses, we're not going to let you offset them in the future. A final point of comparison is that New Jersey allows no carry back and a carry forward of 7 years, where Minnesota law allows a net operating loss carry forward of 15 years. Sort of the purpose of this slide and what I'm attempting to demonstrate to you is that Minnesota law is really more modern than New Jersey law in this area. We allow all of the losses that are allowed at the federal level, and the system is far less restrictive than it is in New Jersey. A final point of comparison, actually this is a comparison of things that are in the proposal versus what is on the books in New Jersey, and I think that this is a very important point of difference is that the current New Jersey law prohibits the sale of net operating losses to a business that's a 5% owner of the seller. If you'll think back to when I was talking to you about the Section 382 limitation and the definition of change in ownership, it's any group of 5% shareholders taking over a company. The effect of this provision is that in New Jersey, if you were prevented from taking losses at the federal level because of the Section 382 limitation, you would not be able to purchase net operating losses from a biotech or emerging tech company that was able to sell them because of the law. The Minnesota proposal before you today does not contain a similar restriction. And because of that, for Minnesota purposes, companies that engage in this program would be able to purchase net operating losses and use them even though they would have been prohibited from doing so by prior law here and would also be prohibited from doing so at the federal level. A few other comparative differences between the Minnesota proposal and current New Jersey law are that New Jersey law currently requires an 80% tax benefit utilization rate, where the Minnesota proposal would require 75. New Jersey also has a $2,500 application fee to participate in the program. And finally, New Jersey requires a more extensive disclosure of financial statements and other information to substantiate qualification for the program than the Minnesota proposal would currently require. Finally, why is all this important? Federal legislation governing loss trafficking is well-developed and has been carefully thought out over a long period of time, from 1918 all the way up until today. Since the inception of net operating loss carryover provisions, federal authorities at the legislative and judicial levels have seen the need for anti-loss trafficking rules, and those have existed since that time. This proposal would cause us to deviate somewhat from that. Finally, the proposed law would allow corporations to utilize net operating losses that they're currently prohibited from claiming because of the Section 382 limitation. That's not something that's currently happening in New Jersey, and it's something that we want to caution you about today. I'd like to thank you all very much for your time and attention, and I will cede the floor to Mr. Cummings at this time.
Mr. Cummings, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we really do appreciate the opportunity to provide context. You know, on the one hand, this is exciting. This is a new idea that we get to look at and think about. But I did want to provide some greater context that this legislation would bring us substantially out of compliance with the federal tax code. Also, because New Jersey has very stringent policies on net operating losses, it may make more sense there. Our policies on net operating losses align with the federal tax code and do allow for greater fluidity. Net operating losses, as Mr. O'Mahony mentioned, were meant to soften the impact from year to year. This would change the nature of that into really a monetized taxed attribute. That Mr. O'Mahony alluded to is that New Jersey does have a strong economic substance doctrine, whereas Minnesota lacks that. So if Minnesota were really to be serious about monetizing these types of tax attributes and taxpayer behavior, it really doesn't make sense to do that in a state that doesn't have strong economic substance. If there is a want to move forward with providing resources to companies that are unprofitable, and I'm not making a value judgment on that. A next logical step may be to make net operating losses refundable, and making that's really not the purpose of net operating losses. All of these factors could substantially change the incentive in setting up and running companies. This would really mean the tax code rather than the economy. Would change the loss limitations for companies buying NOLs and would be a strong incentive to stack losses or change the way businesses run. And that, I think, would be an unintended result. Another alternative, if there was a want to provide some resources to emerging biotech, I know that that's a concern. It may make more sense to have a grant program targeted to the companies in which that would be trying to direct it to. But we really, these are creative ideas, and we wanted to just provide context and be a partner to you, Senator Rest, and to the committee as you think about this and other ideas that come forward.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Any questions for the testifier, Senator Scoy?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might be to Senator Rest, maybe to Mr. Cummings. So we're now going to put a price on the loss, and I get it for the purchaser. If the price is less than the value of the loss, there are money ahead. But how does the seller – is it just the financial return to the seller also, or is there something else? Is there some analysis of the value – I mean – how do you know that the seller has a viable idea? Are they just going to continue downward, or is there anything going on in trying to figure that part of the component out, or is it just they have loss, they sell it for 25 cents on the dollar, and they get a little bit of money back?
Senator Rest.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator Scoy, first of all, the industry sector is targeted here. It's just biotechnology. Oh, yeah. So that's one thing, or technology, but it's not just any old startup company of, you know, wanting to make a better mousetrap, really, right? It's something more significant than that. And and so that's one limitation. Once again, I think we can see that it can be a program that just like the small business credit, the angel investment credit, it can be capped, you know, by application and then capped. So I think that the, even though the revenue estimate comes in at $60 million, and I left that at my desk.
That's great. $60 million
up there. But that's scalable, and we did that in the 2013 bill as well. In the past, we have taken chances in order to stimulate economic growth through the tax system. Sometimes those have been successful. Sometimes they are programs that after a few years are abandoned. I would maintain, although probably we need more time with it as well, that the angel investment credit we're going to see as being successful. The JobZ program, which held such great promise in terms of relief from taxation for companies that chose to build and operate in those zones, ended up being not serving the purpose for which it was intended, but we gave it a chance. At the time, most of us thought, some of us didn't like the total tax relief, but it was a viable proposal, and I believe Senator Bach was the original author of that with the support of Governor Pawlenty. So we gave that program a chance, and there was a risk, and there were upsides and downsides. So I take Mr. Cummings' comment seriously, but I'm not particularly averse to deviating from the federal tax code if it serves and works for Minnesota. I mean, that doesn't deter me particularly. The economic substance argument, we need to have a full discussion, I believe, in the full committee, quite frankly, of that doctrine. And
is it in the policy bill?
It's in the governor's.
And it is in the governor's bill that you are carrying. So maybe either in the division or in the full committee, we should explore that whole area, because that's a very controversial doctrine, and to see whether it's this is the right time for Minnesota to go in that direction as well, and if that gives more comfort in taking on new ideas in this way, then we could discuss that in light of this bill. We have, as you know, we did have this bill in the 2013 bill, and then it dropped out, which is fine. We had other priorities, but I'm really interested in it, and I think it will be an incentive to high-tech startup companies, particularly in the biotech area, which, you know, we're trying to get that niche for ourselves in that area, and I think this would be a great investment and a risk for Minnesota. And if no one else has any questions for the department, I would like to ask the Medical Alley. That's not what they're called. Life Science Alley. Shane to come forward and give his testimony and experience that they've had with this concept.
Any further questions for Mr. Cummings or Mr. Omahone? Senator.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Ress, yes, I would bring up the advocates. I probably should have waited to ask my question until they were here, because really more appropriately to them. But let me just briefly say that and I don't expect an answer today, but at some point, if we could have a conversation about what is the amount that's not too small so it doesn't do anything, mm-hmm. but is also, you know, somewhere in that midpoint that will fit within what we think is our target. Mm-hmm. So that'll be a conversation that we'll have ongoing.
I look forward to that conversation.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen, and we'll bring up the advocates now. Welcome to the committee, and identify yourself for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, my name is Shay Mandel. I'm President and CEO of Life Science Alley, and I actually appreciate most people still refer to us as Medical Alley, and I think that's important in terms of giving you more significant context. In terms of working with the department, of course, we're very interested in working with the department. We've had a lot of meetings on this bill, and this is some new information today and a conversation we've not had, so of course we'll look forward to working with the department. But let me give you a little context. This summer, the American History Museum of the Smithsonian is opening a new exhibit called Places of Invention. And they've selected six great American places of invention: Silicon Valley, Hollywood, the Bronx for hip-hop. And included in those six exhibits is Minnesota's Medical Alley. Now, why is that important? This is all new. This is just happening. So we'll get you all a lot more information, and I'll send we've got artist renderings and such, and we're working with the Bakken Museum to bring the Medical Alley piece back here. But why is that important? The exhibit at the American History Museum goes decade by decade through places of great invention. And it really focuses on the origins of the medical technology industry as a whole, that garage in northeast Minnesota that's so famous, that born Medtronic, and the connection with the University of Minnesota, Mayo, and it really looks at the 50s. And I think the biggest question for those of us here in Minnesota is how we ensure that our legacy continues to be our future. And this bill gives us an opportunity to do that. You know, a lot of the conversation in the department's report focused a lot on how net operating losses are dealt with in the event of an acquisition, the purchase of a company, the transfer of ownership of the corporation as opposed to the tax liabilities, and how those would stay connected. And in fact, this bill isn't attempting to address those issues. We have one example of a state that has put in place specifically because of their pharmaceutical industry. And again, you know, we've always said we have something unique here in Minnesota that we are at risk of losing. And rather than losing, we want to ensure that we maintain that leadership position. This bill's been narrowly tailored specifically to address that. I know there's always questions about propping up bad businesses, but the reality is back in the 50s and 60s, there was no FDA. Dr. Lillehei, Earl Bakken, they had pacemakers saving people's lives in 48 hours. Today, it's 7 years. It's hundreds of millions of dollars. In fact, the business plan for taking a drug or a device to market requires the loss of hundreds of millions of dollars to get there. And so if we're not willing to at least acknowledge that that is the business model and address it, you know, then we face a future where these investments simply don't happen, whether here in Minnesota or any place. And ultimately, things like diabetes, Alzheimer's, neuromodulation techniques, therapies that are being designed and invented in Minnesota don't happen anymore. So, you know, we're here as an advocate to ensure, again, that Minnesota's future looks like our legacy, that Medical Alley, the place where therapies are born and delivered, continues to be Minnesota. And we think this bill ensures our future in the sense that while we have Medtronic, St. Jude, 3M, and large corporations that I think will continue to be successful here, we want to make sure we have what today amounts to about 400 early-stage companies, biotech companies, pharma companies, med tech companies, And this opportunity allows for those companies to get the dollars they need when they need it. And if they are ultimately successful, then they start paying taxes on time, and we get the economic benefit. You all know, we've said many times, and I encourage you to look at New Jersey's report, ultimately, job growth, way up. Wage growth, way up. The state actually made money on the income taxes generated by those companies and individuals far in excess of the credit amount allocated. And the last thing I would mention, here in Minnesota today, the average annual wage for a job in the life sciences is now over $95,000. So if we think about a future where we continue to add these types of jobs, we have the kind of economic growth here in the state that all of us want and that can contribute to solving lots of our other issues. And with that, I thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
All right. Senator, questions for the testifier. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and apologize for not having your name. Mr. Mandel.
Yep.
So if a company has a good idea, is there not some thought that the good ideas will make it? And if they allow the carry forward of the loss, that they would then utilize that into the future to continue their investment as opposed to this more short-term utilization?
Mr. Mandel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, good ideas, I mean, we always start with the premise, if it's a great idea, it's going to make it. Today, in this field, again, you know, I want to be very clear with the committee and Senator Squibb, we're talking about a unique industry, a unique window of regulatory and data collection, clinical trials that don't exist in most industries. We see a lot of good ideas every day that may or may not ultimately make it just because of the cost. So what this would allow a company to do, so let's say that, you know, you and I had tomorrow's great idea and a group of angels and investors, you know, put $20 million into our company. And we thought that would get us through, you know, maybe 18 months, some hires, get to a certain point. And now we're continuing to try to fundraise and move, and we've had some issues with our clinical trial all through that life cycle of 5 years of maybe $100 million, if at the end of every year we could take those losses and we could surrender them and sell them for cash, now all of a sudden without further dilution of the ownership of the company from an investor from out of Minnesota, without having to make choices about can we hire that next engineer or clinical research organization to help us get through that process. Now we've got some working capital, and as I think you all know, you know, working capital in a growing business is the most critical factor to make those investments to ensure, or at least make much more likely that ultimately they will be successful. And again, let me reiterate, this is really hard business. In many ways, it sort of begs the question, why would anybody want to do this? But we've got passionate Minnesotans who look at disease states and are inventing today to solve that problem. It takes a long time and a lot of money. And if we want to make sure we continue to lead in this industry, I think those of us here should be trying to help them as best we can.
Senator Skoy.
Just one last question. And then so do you have any idea what the value of the loss, and this is completely speculation, if you don't know, just say you don't know, but I'm starting to think about this. Clearly the discount's going to be more than the value of money, but what is the discount on the loss, you know, I mean, in New Jersey, what kind of discounts are there for selling your losses early?
Mr. Mandel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy. So in New Jersey, so we put a minimum at 75% in this bill. New Jersey's minimum was 80%, and transparently, we picked a number that was more competitive. But the reality is, in New Jersey, these tax credits effectively go into a marketplace for sale, and so on average, New Jersey's sale of those ran at about 98%. So effectively, what you're talking about is the state giving up roughly 2% on that income, but you're creating a scenario where you're much more likely with those companies getting money for more of them to make it and become taxpayers in the future. And so that's why you see statistically in New Jersey that the number of credits is far lower. The credits let are far lower than the income taxes created by the job growth. So again, New Jersey set a minimum. We selected a minimum to be more competitive. But the reality is in New Jersey that roughly 97-98% has been what the credits have sold for on an annual basis.
Senator Scoy.
So if you've got $100 of loss, you get $97 in year on the year you sell it?
Mr. Mandel.
Mr. Chair. Senator Scoy, that's correct. So if you and I lost, we had a $100 loss, we would sell $100 tax liability on the loss. Yeah, yeah. You and I would sell that tax credit for $97. Another taxpayer would buy that $100 tax credit for $97, apply it. They would save $3. You and I would have $97 to go out and hire people, move our business forward. And that really is the benefit. And then so fast forward 2, 3, 4 years, our business doesn't fail. In fact, we've gone from losing $20 million a year to bringing in $500 million a year. Now we're immediately a taxpayer because we've surrendered our operating losses. And so the state picks up much quicker on those companies that are successful. And I think that's part of where the real benefit in New Jersey came forward, because for these companies that do succeed, they're going to succeed and grow pretty rapidly. These are the kinds of companies that, you know, succeed well or fail. So while we may lose some in the process, those that succeed will generate revenues for the state that will far exceed those credits. And again, in New Jersey over a 10-year period of time, that was very much the case.
Okay, any further questions for Mr. Mandel? All right, thank you. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I really do appreciate the thoughtful discussion and the presentation. And without any further discussion, I would move that.
Senator Scoy.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Mandel, mm-hmm. I want to ask Senator Gazelka's question. And Senator Gazelka asked a question a couple weeks ago that I thought was really good, because we see people in front of this committee advocating for a number of different provisions through the session. Do you have a priority list, and how would this one fit on your priority list?
Mr.
That's
Mandel.
A question for
I'm
not
asking a question of Mr. Mandel, but I was hoping Senator Gazelka would ask it, but he didn't.
Mr. Mandel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, happy to walk through this with you. Our number one priority, as I think all of you know at Life Science Alley, are the changes that have been proposed overall to the R&D tax credit. The reason for that is the R&D tax credit will have the broadest impact on Minnesota's economy. If it's refundable, right. Again, the bills that we're supporting, critical. So we think that was a real differentiator for Minnesota, and in fact, myself and my colleague Genevieve Plumidor both testified that other states are currently attempting to put refundability in New York and others to be more competitive. So certainly the overall package around R&D tax credits is our number one priority. Having said that, from my perspective, I mean, this really is the next critical priority. We're certainly supportive of the investment in the University Medical School, UEL expansion, a host of things that are good for our industry. But I truly believe, and we've advocated and had this conversation with this committee now for 3 years, that, you know, this is a unique period of time, the next 5 years, where the shakeout of this industry is going to happen. We have some inherent advantages here in Minnesota and a tremendous legacy. And I really believe this would change the game significantly for the future companies that we all want to have, and would really help to draw more early stage companies from California, from Massachusetts. I think this would secure our future in this industry for the next half century, and I think this would have as big of impact as anything on doing that.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mandel, and Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To Mr. Mandel, then, as I'm trying to think about these new and upcoming businesses, this, my guess is they, if they've got good ideas and fail, it's because they just didn't have enough cash flow long enough to make it. And so is that correct, that this basically prolongs the life and gives them a longer period of time to make it to that place of being successful, and that's why it's, that's why you like it?
Mr. Mandel.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, that's exactly right. So this just takes a long time. So, you know, investing in medical technology in particular is harder today than it has been historically. One of the reasons it's difficult is the process of getting through the FDA today is much more difficult. And one other point that I think is important here, what Minnesota is most known for are, you know, class 3 medical devices, the most sophisticated devices, the kinds of devices that require a PMA through the FDA, lots of clinical data, et cetera. So, and in fact, we'll send this around, but historically, about a third of all the PMAs that have ever been approved pre-market assessment, I'm sorry. It's, so these are the long time to approval process in the FDA. About a third of the PMA approvals in the history of the world come from here. Hmm. And over the last 10 years, what we've seen, we've always, California and Minnesota have always sort of battled it out. Over the last 5 to 10 years, the gap, which is to say that we're getting better and better between us and California, is quite extreme. Now, that's good news. Here's the bad news. The bad news is, you know, California, you know, isn't growing in this space because it's not as hard, it doesn't take as long, and capital is far more readily available there. So, you know, we've got unique skills, we've got unique inventions, but we also have the very unique challenge of the hardest stuff to get through that really makes a difference and the most money. So as companies are fighting day to day, I mean, we're talking about, you know, $1 million a month burn rates, you know, being able to get $500,000 in surrendering our tax liability might make the difference about whether or not you can hire that one additional expert, who, of course, resides here in Minnesota, to get you through that, that final stage of FDA approval. So, you know, it is, we see companies fail that have had 20, 40, 50 million in investment. And I can assure you, at least over the last 5 years, 99% of the time, that is a product of running out of money in an environment that is just unpredictable.
Thanks.
All right, thank you. Any further questions from the committee?
Okay, Senator. Then, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 1253 be laid over for further consideration, excuse me, in the omnibus tax bill.
As amended, Senator S.
No, there's no amendments, okay. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And to Senator Rest's motion, any discussion? All in favor, aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, we do have another, I think we're meeting every day this week. Is that correct?
No. Wednesday.
Friday.
Maybe you could ask Ms. Schaefer-Pellinen to give us the schedule.
The division will meet again on Wednesday.
The division meets on Wednesday. The full committee meets
Tuesday and Thursday. 8:30.
All at 8:30. So, Mr. Chairman, you can adjourn the hearing.
All right. Thank you. Meeting's adjourned.
Thank you. Senator.